Kathy sat up late, having a world of things to order for the reception of her new friends. She came into the kitchen once to speak to her old one, but he was gone, and she only stayed to ask what was the matter with him, and then went back. In the morning he rose early, and as it was a holiday carried his ill humour onto the moors, not reappearing till the family were departed for church. Fasting and reflection seemed to have brought him to better spirit. He hung about me for a while, and having screwed up his courage, exclaimed abruptly, "Nelly, make me decent. I'm going to be good." "High time, Heathcliff," I said. "You have grieved Catherine. She's sorry she ever came home, I dare say. It looks as if you envied her because she is more thought of than you." The notion of envying Catherine was incomprehensible to him, but the notion of grieving her he understood clearly enough. "Did she say she was grieved?" he inquired, looking very serious. "She cried when I told her you were off again this morning."
"Well, I cried last night," he returned, "and I had more reason to cry than she."
"Yes, you had the reason of going to bed with a proud heart and an empty stomach," said I. "Proud people breed sad sorrows for themselves. But if you be ashamed of your touchiness, you must ask pardon, mind, when she comes in. You must go up and offer to kiss her and say, 'You know best what to say, only do it heartily, and not as if you thought of her converted into a stranger by her grand dress. And now, though I have dinner to get ready, I'll steal time to arrange you, so that Edgar Linton shall look quite a doll beside you, and that he does. You are younger, and yet, I'll be bound, you are taller and twice as broad across the shoulders. You could knock him down in a twinkling. Don't you feel that you could?" Heathcliff's face brightened a moment. Then it was overcast afresh, and he sighed. "But, Nelly, if I knocked him down 20 times, that wouldn't make him less handsome or me more so. Wish I had light hair and fair skin, and was dressed and behaved as well, and had a chance of being as rich as he will be."
"And cried for mamma at every turn," I added, "and trembled if a country lad heaved his fist against you, and sat at home all day for a shower of rain. Oh, Heathcliff, you are showing a poor spirit. Come to the glass, and I'll let you see what you should wish. Do you mark those 2 lines between your eyes, and those thick brows that, instead of rising arch, sink in the middle, and that couple of black fiends so deeply buried, who never open their windows boldly, but lurk glinting under them, like devil spies? Wish and learn to smooth away the surly wrinkles, to raise your lids frankly, and change the fiends to confident, innocent angels, suspecting and doubting nothing, and always seeing friends where they are not sure of foes. Don't get the expression of a vicious cur that appears to know the kicks it gets are its desert, and yet hates all the world as well as the kicker for what it suffers.
In other words, I must wish for Edgar Linton's great blue eyes and even forehead," he replied. "I do, and that won't help me to them."
"A good heart will help you to a bonny face, my lad," I continued, "if you are a regular black, and a bad one will turn the bonniest into something worse than ugly. And now that we've done washing and combing and sulking, tell me whether you don't think yourself rather handsome. I'll tell you I do. You're fit for a prince in disguise. Who knows but your father was Emperor of China, and your mother an Indian queen, each of them able to buy up with 1 week's income Wuthering Heights and Thrushcross Grange together. And you were kidnapped by wicked sailors and brought to England. Were I in your place, I would frame high notions of my birth, and the thoughts of what I should give me courage and dignity to support the oppressions of a little farmer." So I chatted on, and Heathcliff gradually lost his frown and began to look quite pleasant, when all at once our conversation was interrupted by a rumbling sound moving up the road and entering the court. He ran to the window and I to the door, just in time to behold the 2 Lintons descend from the family carriage, smothered in cloaks and fur, and the Earnshaws dismount from their horses. They often rode to church in winter. Catherine took a hand of each of the children and brought them into the house and set them before the fire, which quickly put colour into their white faces. I urged my companion to hasten now and show his amiable humour, and he willingly obeyed. But ill luck would have it that as he opened the door leading from the kitchen on one side, Hindley opened it on the other. They met, and the master, irritated at seeing him clean and cheerful, or perhaps eager to keep his promise to Mrs. Linton, shoved him back with a sudden thrust and angrily bade Joseph,
"Keep the fellow out of the room. Send him into the garret till dinner is over. He'll be cramming his fingers in the tarts and stealing the fruit if left alone with them a minute."
"Nay, sir," I could not avoid answering. "He'll touch nothing, not he. I suppose he must have his share of the dainties as well as we."
"He shall have his share of my hand if I catch him downstairs till dark,"
cried Hindley.
"Begone, you vagabond!"
"What, you are attempting the coxcomb, are you?
Wait till I get hold of those elegant locks. See if I won't pull them a bit longer."
"They are long enough already," observed Master Linton, peeping from the doorway. "I wonder they don't make his head ache. It's like a colt's mane over his eyes." He ventured this remark without any intention to insult, but Heathcliff's violent nature was not prepared to endure the appearance of impertinence from one whom he seemed to hate, even then as a rival. He seized a tureen of hot apple sauce, the first thing that came under his gripe, and dashed it full against the speaker's face and neck, who instantly commenced a lament that brought Isabella and Catherine hurrying to the place. Mr. Earnshaw snatched up the culprit directly and conveyed him to his chamber, where doubtless he administered a rough remedy to cool the fit of passion, for he appeared red and breathless. I got the dishcloth and rather spitefully scrubbed Edgar's nose and mouth, affirming it served him right for meddling. His sister began weeping to go home, and Cathy stood by, confounded, blushing for all.
"You should not have spoken to him," she expostulated with Master Linton. "He was in a bad temper, and now you've spoilt your visit, and he'll be flogged. I hate him to be flogged. I can't eat my dinner. Why did you speak to him, Edgar?"
"I didn't,"
sobbed the youth, escaping from my hands and finishing the remainder of the purification with his cambric pocket handkerchief.
"I promised Mama that I wouldn't say one word to him, and I didn't."
"Well, don't cry," replied Catherine contemptuously. "You're not killed. Don't make more mischief. My brother is coming. Be quiet. Hush, Isabella. Has anybody hurt you?"
"There, there, children, to your seats," cried Hindley, bustling in. "That brute of a lad has warmed me nicely. Next time, Master Edgar, take the law into your own fists. It will give you an appetite."
The little party recovered its equanimity at sight of the fragrant feast. They were hungry after their ride and easily consoled, since no real harm had befallen them. Mr. Earnshaw carved bountiful platefuls, and the mistress made them merry with lively talk. I waited behind the chair and was pained to behold Catherine with dry eyes and an indifferent air commence cutting up the wing of a goose before her. An unfeeling child, I thought to myself. How lightly she dismisses her old playmate's troubles. I could not have imagined her to be so selfish. She lifted a mouthful to her lips, then she set it down again. Her cheeks flushed and the tears gushed over them. She slipped her fork to the floor and hastily dived under the cloth to conceal her emotion. I did not call her unfeeling for long, for I perceived she was in purgatory throughout the day, and wearying to find an opportunity of getting by herself or paying a visit to Heathcliff, who had been locked up by the master, as I discovered on endeavouring to introduce to him a private mess of victuals. In the evening we had a dance. Cathy begged that he might be liberated then, as Isabella Linton had no partner. Her entreaties were vain, and I was appointed to supply the deficiency. We got rid of all gloom in the excitement of the exercise, and our pleasure was increased by the arrival of the Gimmerton band, mustering 15 strong, a trumpet, a trombone, clarinets, bassoons, French horns, and a bass viol, besides singers. They go the rounds of all the respectable houses, and receive contributions every Christmas, and we esteemed it a first-rate treat to hear them. After the usual carols had been sung, we set them to songs and glees. Mrs. Earnshaw loved the music, and so they gave us plenty. Catherine loved it too, but she said it sounded sweetest at the top of the steps, and she went up in the dark. I followed. They shut the house door below, never noting our absence. It was so full of people. She made no stay at the stairs' head, but mounted farther, to the garret where Heathcliff was confined, and called him. He stubbornly declined answering for a while. She persevered,
and finally persuaded him to hold communion with her through the boards. I let the poor things converse unmolested, till I supposed the songs were going to cease, and the singers to get some refreshment. Then I clambered up the ladder to warn her. Instead of finding her outside, I heard her voice within. The little monkey had crept by the skylight of one garret, along the roof, into the skylight of the other, and it was with the utmost difficulty I could coax her out again. When she did come, Heathcliff came with her, and she insisted that I should take him into the kitchen, as my fellow servant had gone to a neighbour's to be removed from the sound of our devil's psalmody, as it pleased him to call it. I told them I intended by no means to encourage their tricks, but as the prisoner had never broken his fast since yesterday's dinner, I would wink at his cheating Mr. Hindley that once. He went down, I set him a stool by the fire, and offered him a quantity of good things. But he was sick and could eat little, and my attempts to entertain him were thrown away. He leant his two elbows on his knees and his chin on his hands and remained wrapped in dumb meditation. On my inquiring the subject of his thoughts, he answered gravely, "I'm trying to settle how I shall pay Hindley back. I don't care how long I wait, if I can only do it at last. I hope he will not die before I do."
"For shame, Heathcliff," said I. "It is for God to punish wicked people. We should learn to forgive."
"No, God won't have the satisfaction that I shall," he returned. "I only wish I knew the best way. Let me alone and I'll plan it out. While I'm thinking of that, I don't feel pain."
"But, Mr. Lockwood, I forget these tales cannot divert you. I'm annoyed how I should dream of chattering on at such a rate, and your gruel cold, and you nodding for bed. I could have told Heathcliff's history all that you need to hear in half a dozen words."
Thus interrupting herself, the housekeeper rose and proceeded to lay aside her sewing, but I felt incapable of moving from the hearth, and I was very far from nodding.
"Sit still, Mrs. Dean," I cried.
"Do sit still another half hour. You've done just right to tell the story leisurely. That is the method I like, and you must finish it in the same style. I am interested in every character you have mentioned, more or less."
"The clock is on the stroke of 11, sir."
"No matter. I'm not accustomed to go to bed in the long hours. 1 or 2 is early enough for a person who lies till 10.
"You shouldn't lie till 10. There's the very prime of the morning gone long before that time. A person who has not done one half his day's work by 10 o'clock runs a chance of leaving the other half undone."
"Nevertheless, Mrs. Dean, resume your chair, because tomorrow I intend lengthening the night till afternoon. I prognosticate for myself an obstinate cold at least."
"Oh, I hope not, sir. Well, you must allow me to leap over some 3 years during that space. Mrs. Earnshaw..."
"No, no. I'll allow nothing of the sort. Are you acquainted with the mood of mind in which, if you were seated alone and the cat licking its kitten on the rug before you, you would watch the operation so intently that Puss's neglect of one ear would put you seriously out of temper?"
"A terribly lazy mood, I should say."
"On the contrary, a tiresomely active one. It is mine at present, and therefore continue minutely. I perceive that people in these regions acquire over people in towns the value that a spider in a dungeon does over a spider in a cottage, to their various occupants, and yet the deepened attraction is not entirely owing to the situation of the looker-on. They do live more in earnest, more in themselves, and less in surface, change in frivolous external things. I could fancy a love for life here almost possible, and I was a fixed unbeliever in any love of a year's standing. One state resembles setting a hungry man down to a single dish, on which he may concentrate his entire appetite and do it justice. The other, introducing him to a table laid out by French cooks. He can perhaps extract as much enjoyment from the whole, but each part is a mere atom in his regard and remembrance."
"Oh, here we are, the same as anyone else when you get to know us," observed Mrs. Dean, somewhat puzzled at my speech.
"Excuse me," I responded. "You, my good friend, are a striking evidence against that assertion. Excepting a few provincialisms of slight consequence, you have no marks of the manners which I am habituated to consider as peculiar to your class. I am sure you have thought a great deal more than the generality of servants think. You have been compelled to cultivate your reflective faculties for want of occasions for frittering your life away on silly trifles. Mrs. Dean laughed.
I certainly esteem myself a steady, reasonable kind of body, she said. Not exactly from living among the hills and seeing one set of faces and one series of actions from year's end to year's end. But I have undergone sharp discipline, which has taught me wisdom, and then I have read more than you would fancy, Mr. Lockwood. You could not open a book in this library that I have not looked into and got something out of also, unless it be that range of Greek and Latin and that of French. And those I know one from another. It is as much as you can expect of a poor man's daughter. However, if I am to follow my story in true gossip's fashion, I had better go on, and instead of leaping 3 years, I will be content to pass to the next summer, the summer of 1778. That is nearly 23 years ago. Chapter 8. On the morning of a fine June day, my first bonny little nursling and the last of the ancient Earnshaw stock was born. We were busy with the hay in the faraway field when the girl that usually brought our breakfast came running an hour too soon across the meadow and up the lane, calling me as she ran.
"Oh, such a grand bairn," she panted out. "The finest lad that ever breathed, but the doctor says missus must go. He says she's been in a consumption these many months. I heard him tell Mr. Hindley, and now she has nothing to keep her, and she'll be dead before winter. You must come home directly. You're to nurse it, Nelly, to feed it with sugar and milk, and take care of it day and night. I wish I were you, because it will be all yours when there is no missus."
"But is she very ill?"
I asked, flinging down my rake and tying my bonnet. "I guess she is, yet she looks bravely," replied the girl. "And she talks as if she thought of living to see it grow a man. She's out of her head for joy. It's such a beauty. If I were her, I'm certain I should not die. I should get better at the bare sight of it, in spite of Kenneth. I was fairly mad at him. Dame Archer brought the cherub down to master in the house, and his face just began to light up when the old croaker steps forward and says he,
'Earnshaw, it's a blessing your wife has been spared to leave you this son. When she came, I felt convinced we shouldn't keep her long, and now I must tell you the winter will probably finish her. Don't take on and fret about it too much. It can't be helped. And besides, you should have known better than to choose such a rush of a lass.'
"And what did the master answer?" I inquired. "I think he swore, but I didn't mind him. I was straining to see the bairn." And she began again to describe it rapturously. I, as zealous as herself, hurried eagerly home to admire. On my part, though I was very sad for Hindley's sake, he had room in his heart only for two idols, his wife and himself. He doted on both and adored one, and I couldn't conceive how he would bear the loss. When we got to Wuthering Heights, there he stood at the front door, and as I passed in, I asked, "How was the baby?"
"Nearly ready to run about now," he replied,
putting on a cheerful smile. "And the mistress?" I ventured to inquire.
"The doctor says she's..."
"Damn the doctor," he interrupted, reddening. "Frances is quite right. She'll be perfectly well by this time next week.
Are you going upstairs? Will you tell her that I'll come if she'll promise not to talk? I left her because she would not hold her tongue, and she must. Tell her Kenneth says she must be quiet."
I delivered the message to Mrs. Earnshaw. She seemed in flighty spirits and replied merrily. "I hardly spoke a word, Ellen, and there he is, gone out twice crying. Well, say, I promise I won't speak, but that does not bind me not to laugh at him." Poor soul, till within a week of her death that gay heart never failed her, and her husband persisted doggedly, nay, furiously, in affirming her health improved every day. When Kenneth warned him that his medicines were useless at that stage of the malady, and he needn't put him to further expense by attending her, he retorted,
"I know you need not. She's well. She does not want any more attendance from you. She never was in a consumption. It was a fever, and it is gone. Her pulse is as slow as mine now, and her cheek as cool."
He told his wife the same story, and she seemed to believe him. But one night, while leaning on his shoulder, in the act of saying she thought she should be able to get up tomorrow. A fit of coughing took her, a very slight one. He raised her in his arms. She put her two hands about his neck. Her face changed, and she was dead. As the girl anticipated, the child Hareton fell wholly into my hands. Mr. Earnshaw, provided he saw him healthy and never heard him cry, was contented as far as regarded him. For himself, he grew desperate. His sorrow was of that kind that will not lament. He neither wept nor prayed. He cursed and defied, execrated God and man, and gave himself up to reckless dissipation. The servants could not bear his tyrannical and evil conduct long. Joseph and I were the only two that would stay. I had not the heart to leave my charge. And besides, you know, I had been his foster sister, and excused his behaviour more readily than a stranger would. Joseph remained to hector other tenants and labourers, and because it was his vocation to be where he had plenty of wickedness to reprove. The master's bad ways and bad companions formed a pretty example for Catherine and Heathcliff. His treatment of the latter was enough to make a fiend of a saint. And truly, it appeared as if the lad were possessed of something diabolical at that period. He delighted to witness Hindley degrading himself past redemption, and became daily more notable for savage sullenness and ferocity. I could not half tell what an infernal house we had. The curate dropped calling, and nobody decent came near us. At last, unless Edgar Linton's visits to Miss Cathy might be an exception. At 15 she was the queen of the countryside. She had no peer, and she did turn out a haughty, headstrong creature. I own I did not like her after infancy was past, and I vexed her frequently by trying to bring down her arrogance. She never took an aversion to me, though. She had a wondrous constancy to old attachments. Even Heathcliff kept his hold on her affections unalterably, and young Linton, with all his superiority, found it difficult to make an equally deep impression. He was my late master. That is his portrait over the fireplace. It used to hang on one side and his wife's on the other, but hers has been removed, or else you might see something of what she was. Can you make that out? Mrs. Dean raised the candle, and I discerned a soft-featured face exceedingly resembling the young lady at the Heights, but more pensive and amiable in expression. It formed a sweet picture. The long, light hair curled slightly on the temples. The eyes were large and serious. The figure almost too graceful. I did not marvel how Catherine Earnshaw could forget her first friend for such an individual. I marvelled much how he, with a mind to correspond with his person, could fancy my idea of Catherine Earnshaw. "A very agreeable portrait," I observed to the housekeeper. "Is it like?" "Yes," she answered. "But he looked better when he was animated. That is his everyday countenance. He wanted spirit in general." Catherine had kept up her acquaintance with the Lintons since her 5 weeks' residence among them, and as she had no temptation to show her rough side in their company, and had the sense to be ashamed of being rude where she experienced such invariable courtesy, she imposed unwittingly on the old lady and gentleman by her ingenious cordiality, gained the admiration of Isabella and the heart and soul of her brother. Acquisitions that flattered her from the first, for she was full of ambition, and led her to adopt a double character without exactly intending to deceive anyone. In the place where she heard Heathcliff termed a vulgar young ruffian, and worse than a brute, she took care not to act like him, but at home she had small inclination to practice politeness that would only be laughed at, and restrain an unruly nature when it would bring her neither credit nor praise. Mr. Edgar seldom mustered courage to visit Wuthering Heights openly. He had a terror of Earnshaw's reputation, and shrunk from encountering him, and yet he was always received with our best attempts at civility. The master himself avoided offending him, knowing why he came, and if he could not be gracious, kept out of the way. I rather think his appearance there was distasteful to Catherine. She was not artful, never played the coquette, and had evidently an objection to her two friends meeting at all.
For when Heathcliff expressed contempt of Linton in his presence, she could not half coincide as she did in his absence. And when Linton evinced disgust and antipathy to Heathcliff, she dared not treat his sentiments with indifference. As if depreciation of her playmate were of scarcely any consequence to her. I've had many a laugh at her perplexities and untold troubles, which she vainly strove to hide from my mockery. That sounds ill-natured, but she was so proud it became really impossible to pity her distresses, till she should be chastened into more humility. She did bring herself finally to confess and to confide in me. There was not a soul else that she might fashion into an adviser. Mr. Hindley had gone from home one afternoon, and Heathcliff presumed to give himself a holiday on the strength of it. He had reached the age of 16 then, I think, and without having bad features or being deficient in intellect, he contrived to convey an impression of inward and outward repulsiveness that his present aspect retained no traces of. In the first place, he had by that time lost the benefit of his early education. Continual hard work, begun soon and concluded late, had extinguished any curiosity he once possessed in pursuit of knowledge, and any love for books or learning. His childhood's sense of superiority instilled into him by the favours of old Mr. Earnshaw was faded away. He struggled long to keep up an equality with Catherine in her studies, and yielded with poignant though silent regret, but he yielded completely. And there was no prevailing on him to take a step in the way of moving upward when he found he must necessarily sink beneath his former level. Then personal appearance sympathised with mental deterioration. He acquired a slouching gait and ignoble look. His naturally reserved disposition was exaggerated into an almost idiotic excess of unsociable moroseness, and he took a grim pleasure, apparently in exciting the aversion rather than the esteem of his few acquaintance. Catherine and he were constant companions still at his seasons of respite from labour, but he had ceased to express his fondness for her in words, and recoiled with angry suspicion from her girlish caresses, as if conscious there could be no gratification in lavishing such marks of affection on him. On the before-named occasion, he came into the house to announce his intention of doing nothing, while I was assisting Miss Cathy to arrange her dress. She had not reckoned on his taking it into his head to be idle, and imagining she would have the whole place to herself, she managed by some means to inform Mr. Edgar of her brother's absence, and was then preparing to receive him. "Cathy, are you busy this afternoon?" asked Heathcliff. "Are you going anywhere?" "No, it is raining," she answered. "Why have you that silk frock on, then?" he said. "Nobody coming, I hope."
"Not that I know of,"
stammered Miss.
"You should be in the field now, Heathcliff. It is an hour past dinner time. I thought you were gone."
"Hindley does not often free us from his accursed presence," observed the boy. "I'll not work any more today. I'll stay with you."
"Oh, but Joseph will tell,"
she suggested.
"You'd better go."
"Joseph is loading lime on the further side of Penistone Crags. It'll take him till dark and he'll never know." So saying, he lounged to the fire and sat down. Catherine reflected an instant with knitted brows. She found it needful to smooth the way for an intrusion.
"Isabella and Edgar Linton talked of calling this afternoon,"
she said at the conclusion of a minute's silence.
"As it rains, I hardly expect them, but they may come, and if they do, you run the risk of being scolded for no good."
"Order Ellen to say you are engaged, Cathy," he persisted. "Don't turn me out for those pitiful, silly friends of yours. I'm on the point sometimes of complaining that they..." "Oh, but I'll not."
"That they what?"
cried Catherine, gazing at him with a troubled countenance.
"Oh, Nelly,"
she added petulantly, jerking her head away from my hands.
"You've combed my hair quite out of curl. That's enough. Let me alone. What are you on the point of complaining about, Heathcliff?"
"Nothing. Only look at the almanac on that wall."
He pointed to a framed sheet hanging near the window and continued.
"The crosses are for the evenings you have spent with the Lintons, the dots for those spent with me. Do you see? I've marked every day."
"Yes, very foolish, as if I took notice," replied Catherine in a peevish tone. "And where is the sense of that?
"'To show that I do take notice,' said Heathcliff.
"'And should I always be sitting with you?'
she demanded, growing more irritated.
"'What good do I get? What do you talk about? You might be dumb or a baby for anything you say to amuse me, or for anything you do either. You never told me before that I talk too little, or that you dislike my company, Cathy,'
exclaimed Heathcliff in much agitation. "'It's no company at all when people know nothing and say nothing,' she muttered. Her companion rose up, but he hadn't time to express his feelings further, for a horse's feet were heard on the flags, and having knocked gently, young Linton entered, his face brilliant with delight at the unexpected summons he had received. Doubtless Catherine marked the difference between her friends as one came in and the other went out. The contrast resembled what you see in exchanging a bleak, hilly coal country for a beautiful, fertile valley, and his voice and greeting were as opposite as his aspect. He had a sweet, low manner of speaking, and pronounced his words as you do. That's less gruff than we talk here, and softer. "'I'm not come too soon, am I?' he said, casting a look at me. I had begun to wipe the plate and tidy some drawers at the far end in the dresser.
"'No,'
answered Catherine.
"'What are you doing, Nelly?'
"'My work, miss,' I replied. Mr. Hindley had given me directions to make a third party in any private visits Linton chose to pay. She stepped behind me and whispered crossly,
"'Take yourself and your dusters off. When company are in the house, servants don't commence scouring and cleaning in the room where they are.'
"'It's a good opportunity now that Master is away,' I answered aloud. "'He hates me to be fidgeting over these things in his presence. I'm sure Mr. Edgar will excuse me.'
"'I hate you to be fidgeting in my presence,'
exclaimed the young lady imperiously, not allowing her guest time to speak. She had failed to recover her equanimity since the little dispute with Heathcliff. "'I'm sorry for it, Miss Catherine,' was my response, and I proceeded assiduously with my occupation. She, supposing Edgar could not see her, snatched the cloth from my hand and pinched me, with a prolonged wrench, very spitefully on the arm. I've said I did not love her, and rather relished mortifying her vanity now and then. Besides, she hurt me extremely. So I started up from my knees and screamed out,
"'Oh, miss, that's a nasty trick! You have no right to nip me, and I'm not going to bear it!' "'I didn't touch you, you lying creature!'
cried she, her fingers tingling to repeat the act, and her ears red with rage. She never had power to conceal her passion. It always set her whole complexion in a blaze.
"'What's that, then?'
I retorted, showing a decided purple witness to refute her. She stamped her foot, wavered a moment, and then, irresistibly impelled by the naughty spirit within her, slapped me on the cheek, a stinging blow that filled both my eyes with water.
"'Catherine, love, Catherine!'
interposed Linton, greatly shocked at the double fault of falsehood and violence which his idol had committed.
"'Leave the room, Ellen!'
she repeated, trembling all over. Little Hareton, who followed me everywhere, and was sitting near me on the floor, at seeing my tears commenced crying himself and sobbed out complaints against wicked Aunt Cathy, which drew her fury onto his unlucky head. She seized his shoulders and shook him till the poor child waxed livid, and Edgar thoughtlessly laid hold of her hands to deliver him. In an instant, one was wrung free, and the astonished young man felt it applied over his own ear in a way that could not be mistaken for jest. He drew back in consternation. I lifted Hareton in my arms and walked off to the kitchen with him, leaving the door of communication open, for I was curious to watch how they would settle their disagreement. The insulted visitor moved to the spot where he had laid his hat, pale and with a quivering lip. "'That's right,' I said to myself. "'Take warning and begone. It's a kindness to let you have a glimpse of her genuine disposition.'
"'Where are you going?'
demanded Catherine, advancing to the door. He swerved aside and attempted to pass.
"'You must not go!'
she exclaimed energetically. "'I must and I shall,' he replied in a subdued voice.
"'No!'
she persisted, grasping the handle.
"'Not yet, Edgar Linton. Sit down. You shall not leave me in that temper!' I shall be miserable all night, and I won't be miserable for you.
Can I stay after you have struck me? Asked Linton. Catherine was mute.
You've made me afraid and ashamed of you, he continued. I'll not come here again.
Her eyes began to glisten and her lids to twinkle.
And you told a deliberate untruth, he said.
I didn't, she cried, recovering her speech. I did nothing deliberately. Well, go, if you please. Get away, and now I'll cry. I'll cry myself sick.
She dropped down on her knees by a chair and set to weeping in serious earnest.
Edgar persevered in his resolution as far as the court. There he lingered. I resolved to encourage him.
Mrs. Dreadfully Wayward, sir, I called out. As bad as any mad child, you'd better be riding home or else she will be sick, only to grieve us.
The soft thing looked askance through the window. He possessed the power to depart as much as a cat possesses the power to leave a mouse half-killed or a bird half-eaten.
Ah, I thought, there'll be no saving him.
He's doomed and flies to his fate. And so it was. He turned abruptly, hastened into the house again, shut the door behind him, and when I went in a while after to inform them that Earnshaw had come home rabid drunk, ready to pull the whole place about our ears, his ordinary frame of mind in that condition, I saw the quarrel had merely affected a closer intimacy, had broken the outworks of youthful timidity, and enabled them to forsake the disguise of friendship and confess themselves lovers. Intelligence of Mr. Hindley's arrival drove Linton speedily to his horse, and Catherine to her chamber. I went to hide little Hareton, and to take the shot out of the master's fowling piece, which he was fond of playing with in his insane excitement, to the hazard of the lives of any who provoked or even attracted his notice too much. And I had hit upon the plan of removing it, that he might do less mischief if he did go the length of firing the gun.
Chapter 9. He entered vociferating oaths dreadful to hear, and caught me in the act of stowing his son in the kitchen cupboard. Hareton was impressed with a wholesome terror of encountering either his wild beast's fondness or his madman's rage. For in one he ran a chance of being squeezed and kissed to death, and in the other of being flung into the fire or dashed against the wall, and the poor thing remained perfectly quiet wherever I chose to put him.
"There, I've found it out at last,"
cried Hindley, pulling me back by the skin of my neck like a dog.
"By heaven and hell, you've sworn between you to murder that child. I know how it is now, that he is always out of my way. But with the help of Satan, I shall make you swallow the carving knife, Nelly. You needn't laugh, for I've just crammed Kenneth head downmost in the Black Horse Marsh. And two is the same as one, and I want to kill some of you. I shall have no rest till I do."
"But I don't like the carving knife, Mr. Hindley," I answered. "It has been cutting red herrings. I'd rather be shot, if you please."
"You'd rather be damned," he said. "And so you shall. No law in England can hinder a man from keeping his house decent and mine's abominable. Open your mouth."
He held the knife in his hand and pushed its point between my teeth. But for my part, I was never much afraid of his vagaries. I spat out and affirmed it tasted detestable. I would not take it on any account.
"Oh,"
said he, releasing me.
"I see that hideous little villain is not
Hareton. I beg your pardon, Nell. If it be, he deserves flaying alive for not running to welcome me, and for screaming as if I were a goblin. Unnatural cub, come hither. I'll teach thee to impose on a good-hearted, deluded father. Now, don't you think the lad would be handsomer cropped? Makes a dog fiercer, and I love something fierce. Get me a scissors. Something fierce and trim. Besides, devilish conceit it is to cherish our ears. We're asses enough without them. Hush, child, hush!"
"Well, then it is, my darling.
Whisht! Dry thy eyes. There's a joy. Kiss me."
"What?
It won't.
Kiss me, Hareton. Damn thee, kiss me. By God, as if I would rear such a monster. As sure as I'm living, I'll break the brat's neck.
Poor Hareton was squalling and kicking in his father's arms with all his might, and redoubled his yells when he carried him upstairs and lifted him over the banister. I cried out that he would frighten the child into fits and ran to rescue him. As I reached them, Hindley leant forward on the rails to listen to a noise below, almost forgetting what he had in his hands.
"Who is that?"
he asked, hearing someone approaching the stair's foot. I leant forward also for the purpose of signing to Heathcliff, whose step I recognised, not to come further. And, at the instant when my eye quitted Hareton, he gave a sudden spring, delivered himself from the careless grasp that held him, and fell. There was scarcely time to experience a thrill of horror before we saw that the little wretch was safe. Heathcliff arrived underneath just at the critical moment. By a natural impulse, he arrested his descent, and setting him on his feet, looked up to discover the author of the accident. A miser who has parted with a lucky lottery ticket for 5 shillings and finds next day he has lost in the bargain £5,000 could not show a blanker countenance than he did on beholding the figure of Mr. Earnshaw above. It expressed plainer than words could do the intensest anguish at having made himself the instrument of thwarting his own revenge. Had it been dark, I dare say he would have tried to remedy the mistake by smashing Hareton's skull on the steps. But we witnessed his salvation, and I was presently below with my precious charge pressed to my heart. Hindley descended more leisurely, sobered and abashed.
"It is your fault," he said. "You should have kept him out of sight. You should have taken him from me. Is he injured anywhere?" "Injured?" I cried angrily. "If he is not killed, he'll be an idiot. Oh, I wonder his mother does not rise from her grave to see how you use him. You're worse than a heathen, treating your own flesh and blood in that manner."
He attempted to touch the child, who, on finding himself with me, sobbed off his terror directly. At the first finger his father laid on him, however, he shrieked again louder than before, and struggled as if he would go into convulsions.
"You shall not meddle with him," I continued. "He hates you. They all hate you. That's the truth. A happy family you have, and a pretty state you'll come to." "I shall come to a prettier yet, Nelly," laughed the misguided man, recovering his hardness. "At present convey yourself and him away, and hark you, Heathcliff, clear you two quite from my reach and hearing. I wouldn't murder you tonight, unless perhaps I set the house on fire, but that's as my fancy goes."
While saying this, he took a pint bottle of brandy from the dresser and poured some into a tumbler.
"Nay, don't," I entreated. "Mr. Hindley, do take warning. Have mercy on this unfortunate boy, if you care nothing for yourself."
"Anyone will do better for him than I shall," he answered.
"Have mercy on your own soul,"
I said, endeavouring to snatch the glass from his hand.
"Not I. On the contrary, I shall have great pleasure in sending it to perdition to punish its maker,"
exclaimed the blasphemer.
"Here's to its hearty damnation."
He drank the spirits and impatiently bade us go, terminating his command with a sequel of horrid imprecations too bad to repeat or remember.
"It's a pity he cannot kill himself with drink," observed Heathcliff, muttering an echo of curses back when the door was shut.
"He's doing his very utmost, but his constitution defies him. Mr. Kenneth says he would wager his mare that he'll outlive any man on this side Gimmerton, and go to the grave a hoary sinner, unless some happy chance out of the common cause befall him." I went into the kitchen and sat down to lull my little lamb to sleep. Heathcliff, as I thought, walked through to the barn. It turned out afterwards that he only got as far as the other side of the settle, when he flung himself on a bench by the wall, removed from the fire, and remained silent. I was rocking Hareton on my knee and humming a song that began,
It was far in the night, and the bear and his grat, the mither beneath, the mools heard that. When Miss Cathy, who had listened to the hubbub from her room, put her head in and whispered,
"Are you alone, Nelly?"
"Yes, miss," I replied. She entered and approached the hearth. I, supposing she was going to say something, looked up. The expression of her face seemed disturbed and anxious. Her lips were half asunder, as if she meant to speak, and she drew a breath, but it escaped in a sigh instead of a sentence. I resumed my song, not having forgotten her recent behaviour. "Where's Heathcliff?" she said, interrupting me.
"About his work in the stable," was my answer.
He did not contradict me. Perhaps he had fallen into a doze. There followed another long pause, during which I perceived a drop or two trickle from Catherine's cheek to the flags. "Is she sorry for her shameful conduct?" I asked myself. "That will be a novelty. But she may come to the point as she will. I shan't help her." No, she felt small trouble regarding any subject save her own concerns.
"Oh, dear,"
she cried at last.
"I'm very unhappy."
"A pity," I observed. "You're hard to please, so many friends and so few cares, and can't make yourself content."
"Nelly, will you keep a secret for me?"
she pursued, kneeling down by me, and lifting her winsome eyes to my face with that sort of look which turns off bad temper, even when one has all the right in the world to indulge it. "Is it worth keeping?" I inquired, less sulkily.
"Yes, and it worries me, and I must let it out. I want to know what I should do. Today Edgar Linton has asked me to marry him, and I've given him an answer. Now before I tell you whether it was consent or denial, you tell me which it ought to have been."
"Really, Miss Catherine, how can I know?" I replied. "To be sure, considering the exhibition you performed in his presence this afternoon, I might say it would be wise to refuse him. Since he asked you after that, he must either be hopelessly stupid or a venturesome fool."
"If you talk so, I won't tell you any more,"
she returned peevishly, rising to her feet.
"I accepted him, Nelly.
Be quick, and say whether I was wrong."
"You accepted him? Then what good is it discussing the matter? You have pledged your word and cannot retract."
"But say whether I should have done so. Do!"
she exclaimed in an irritated tone, chafing her hands together and frowning. "There are many things to be considered before that question can be answered properly," I said sententiously. "First and foremost, do you love Mr. Edgar?"
"Who can help it? Of course I do," she answered.
Then I put her through the following catechism. For a girl of 22, it was not injudicious. "Why do you love him, Miss Cathy?"
"Nonsense. I do. That's sufficient."
"By no means. You must say why."
"Well, because he is handsome and pleasant to be with."
"Bad," was my commentary.
"And because he is young and cheerful."
"Bad still."
"And because he loves me."
"Indifferent, coming there."
"And he will be rich, and I shall like to be the greatest woman of the neighbourhood, and I shall be proud of having such a husband."
"Worst of all. And now say how you love him."
"As everybody loves..."
"But you're silly, Nelly."
"Not at all. Answer."
"I love the ground under his feet and the air over his head and everything he touches and every word he says. I love all his looks and all his actions and him entirely and altogether."
"There now."
"And why?"
"Nay, you are making a jest of it. It is exceedingly ill-natured. It's no jest to me,"
said the young lady, scowling and turning her face to the fire. "I'm very far from jesting, Miss Catherine," I replied. "You love Mr. Edgar because he is handsome and young and cheerful and rich and loves you. The last, however, goes for nothing. You would love him without that, probably, and with it, you wouldn't,
unless he possessed the four former attractions. No, to be sure not. I should only pity him, hate him perhaps if he were ugly and a clown. But there are several other handsome, rich young men in the world, handsomer possibly, and richer than he is. What should hinder you from loving them? If there be any, they are out of my way. I've seen none like Edgar. You may see some, and he won't always be handsome, and young, and may not always be rich. He is now, and I have only to do with the present.
I wish you would speak rationally.
Well, that settles it. If you have only to do with the present, marry Mr. Linton.
I don't want your permission for that. I shall marry him. And yet you have not told me whether I'm right.
Perfectly right, if people be right to marry only for the present. And now let us hear what you are unhappy about. Your brother will be pleased. The old lady and gentleman will not object, I think. You will escape from a disorderly, comfortless home into a wealthy, respectable one. And you love Edgar, and Edgar loves you. All seems smooth and easy. Where is the obstacle?
Here and here,
replied Catherine, striking one hand on her forehead and the other on her breast.
In whichever place the soul lives, my soul and my heart, I'm convinced I'm wrong.
That's very strange. I cannot make it out.
It's my secret. But if you will not mock at me, I'll explain it. I can't do it distinctly, but I'll give you a feeling of how I feel.
She seated herself by me again. Her countenance grew sadder and graver, and her clasped hands trembled.
Nelly, do you never dream queer dreams?
She said suddenly, after some minutes' reflection. Yes, now and then, I answered.
And so do I. I've dreamt in my life dreams that have stayed with me ever after, and changed my ideas. They've gone through and through me, like wine through water, and altered the colour of my mind. In this one I'm going to tell it, but take care not to smile at any part of it. Oh, don't, Miss Catherine, I cried. We're dismal enough without conjuring up ghosts and visions to perplex us. Come, come, be merry and like yourself. Look at little Hareton. He's dreaming nothing dreary. How sweetly he smiles in his sleep. Yes, yes, and how sweetly his father curses in his solitude. You remember him, I dare say, when he was just such another as that chubby thing, nearly as young and innocent. However, Nelly, I shall oblige you to listen. It's not long, and I've no power to be merry tonight.
I won't hear it! I won't hear it!
I repeated hastily. I was superstitious about dreams then, and am still, and Catherine had an unusual gloom in her aspect that made me dread something from which I might shape a prophecy and foresee a fearful catastrophe. She was vexed, but she did not proceed. Apparently taking up another subject, she recommenced in a short time. If I were in heaven, Nelly, I should be extremely miserable. Because you are not fit to go there, I answered. All sinners would be miserable in heaven. But it is not for that. I dreamt once that I was there. I tell you, I won't hearken to your dreams, Miss Catherine. I'll go to bed. I interrupted again. She laughed and held me down, for I made a motion to leave my chair.
This is nothing, she cried.
I was only going to say that heaven did not seem to be my home, and I broke my heart with weeping to come back to earth, and the angels were so angry that they flung me out into the middle of the heath on the top of Wuthering Heights, where I woke sobbing for joy. That will do to explain my secret as well as the other. I've no more business to marry Edgar Linton than I have to be in heaven. And if the wicked man in there had not brought Heathcliff so low, I shouldn't have thought of it. It would degrade me to marry Heathcliff now. So he shall never know how I love him. And that not because he's handsome, Nelly, but because he's more myself than I am. Whatever our souls are made of, his and mine, are the same. And Linton's is as different as a moonbeam from lightning, or frost from fire. Ere this speech ended, I became sensible of Heathcliff's presence. Having noticed a slight movement, I turned my head, and saw him rise from the bench and steal out noiselessly. He had listened till he heard Catherine say it would degrade her to marry him, and then he stayed to hear no further. My companion, sitting on the ground, was prevented by the back of the settle from remarking his presence or departure, but I started and bade her hush.
"Why?"
she asked, gazing nervously round.
"Joseph is here,"
I answered, catching opportunity the roll of his cartwheels up the road.
"And Heathcliff will come in with him. I'm not sure whether he were not at the door this moment."
"Oh, he couldn't overhear me at the door," said she. "Give me Hareton while you get the supper, and when it is ready, ask me to sup with you. I want to cheat my uncomfortable conscience, and be convinced that Heathcliff has no notion of these things."
"He has not, has he? He does not know what being in love is."
"I see no reason that he should not know as well as you," I returned. "And if you are his choice, he'll be the most unfortunate creature that ever was born. As soon as you become Mrs. Linton, he loses friend and love and all.
Have you considered how you'll bear the separation? And how he'll bear to be quite deserted in the world, because Miss Catherine..." "He quite deserted? We separated?"
she exclaimed with an accent of indignation.
"Who is to separate us, pray?" "They'll meet the fate of Milo. Not as long as I live, Ellen, for no mortal creature. Every Linton on the face of the earth might melt into nothing before I could consent to forsake Heathcliff." "Oh, that's not what I intended. That's not what I mean. I shouldn't be Mrs. Linton were such a price demanded.
He'll be as much to me as he has been all his lifetime. Edgar must shake off his antipathy and tolerate him, at least.
He will, when he learns my true feelings towards him. Nelly, I see now you think me a selfish wretch, but did it never strike you that if Heathcliff and I married, we should be beggars? Whereas if I marry Linton, I can aid Heathcliff to rise and place him out of my brother's power."
"With your husband's money, Miss Catherine?" I asked. "You'll find him not so pliable as you calculate upon, and though I'm hardly a judge, I think that's the worst motive you've given yet for being the wife of young Linton."
"It is not," retorted she. "It is the best. The others were the satisfaction of my whims, and for Edgar's sake too, to satisfy him. This is for the sake of one who comprehends in his person my feelings to Edgar and myself. I cannot express it, but surely you and everybody have a notion that there is or should be an existence of yours beyond you. What were the use of my creation if I were entirely contained here? My great miseries in this world have been Heathcliff's miseries, and I watched and felt each from the beginning. My great thought in living is himself. If all else perished and he remained, I should still continue to be, and if all else remained and he were annihilated, the universe would turn to a mighty stranger. I should not seem a part of it. My love for Linton is like the foliage in the woods. Time will change it, I'm well aware, as winter changes the trees. My love for Heathcliff resembles the eternal rock beneath, a source of little visible delight but necessary. Nelly, I am Heathcliff. He's always, always in my mind. Not as a pleasure, any more than I am always a pleasure to myself, but as my own being. So don't talk of our separation again. It is impracticable. And..." She paused and hid her face in the folds of my gown, but I jerked it forcibly away. I was out of patience with her folly. "If I can make any sense of your nonsense, miss," I said, "it only goes to convince me that you are ignorant of the duties you undertake in marrying, or else that you are a wicked, unprincipled girl. But trouble me with no more secrets. I'll not promise to keep them." "You'll keep that?" she asked eagerly.
"No, I'll not promise," I repeated. She was about to insist when the entrance of Joseph finished our conversation, and Catherine removed her seat to a corner and nursed Hareton while I made the supper. After it was cooked, my fellow servant and I began to quarrel who should carry some to Mr. Hindley, and we didn't settle it till all was nearly cold. Then we came to the agreement that we would let him ask if he wanted any,
for we feared particularly to go into his presence when he had been some time alone.
And how isn't that nowt comed in from field by this time? What is he about? Get idle, seat,
demanded the old man, looking round for Heathcliff.
I'll call him,
I replied. He's in the barn, I've no doubt. I went and called, but got no answer. On returning, I whispered to Catherine that he had heard a good part of what she said, I was sure, and told how I saw him quit the kitchen just as she complained of her brother's conduct regarding him. She jumped up in a fine fright, flung Hareton onto the settle, and ran to seek for her friend herself, not taking leisure to consider why she was so flurried, or how her talk would have affected him. She was absent such a while that Joseph proposed we should wait no longer. He cunningly conjectured they were staying away in order to avoid hearing his protracted blessing. They were
ill enough for only foul manners,
he affirmed, and on their behalf he added that night a special prayer to the usual quarter of an hour's supplication before meat, and would have tacked another to the end of the grace had not his young mistress broken in upon him with a hurried command that he must run down the road, and, wherever Heathcliff had rambled, find and make him re-enter directly.
"I want to speak to him, and I must, before I go upstairs,"
she said.
"And the gate is open. He is somewhere out of hearing, for he would not reply, though I shouted at the top of the fold as loud as I could."
Joseph objected at first. She was too much in earnest, however, to suffer contradiction, and at last he placed his hat on his head and walked grumbling forth. Meantime, Catherine paced up and down the floor, exclaiming,
"I wonder where he is. I wonder where he can be. What did I say, Nelly? I've forgotten. Was he vexed at my bad humour this afternoon? Dear, tell me what I've said to grieve him. I do wish he'd come. I do wish he would." "What a noise for nothing,"
I cried, though rather uneasy myself.
"What a trifle scares you. It is surely no great cause of alarm that Heathcliff should take a moonlight saunter on the moors.
Or even lie too sulky to speak to us in the hayloft. I'll engage he's lurking there. See if I don't ferret him out." I departed to renew my search. Its result was disappointment, and Joseph's quest ended in the same.
"The young lad's gone war and war,"
observed he on re-entering.
"His left gate at full swing, and Mrs. Pony has trodden down two rings of corn and plotted through, right o' at Medder. And some divot at master will play to devil to morn, and he'll do will. His patience itself is sit careless, a fold craters,